And welcome to the Midday with Norman and Vicki and company.
We're so pleased to have organist Thomas Trotter with us, who's just arrived in the country for concerts this weekend with the Madison Symphony Orchestra. Thanks for taking a couple of minutes away from that wonderful organ and joining us in the studio.
Pleasure.
You know, it's the accent, regardless of what he says about the music.
We just like to hear that.
Will win over so many.
I'm putting on my best English accent.
Well, it's very convincing.
Well, it's going to have to turn to American when you play the Barber, and to French when you're playing the Guillemont Symphony.
Yeah.
So a couple of different things going on there. I'm just wondering, as you arrive at an instrument, of course, you have some history with the overture concert organ, but I'm curious what you think about when you start to pull all of the stops and create the colors. What do you look for when you start to do that?
Well, first of all, you have to develop in your own mind a blueprint of the organ. You have to try all the different stops and see which stops work with one another best. And then once you've got a plan of the instrument and what it does firmly in your mind, then you set about applying that plan to the music you're going to play. And, for example, in the Barber, I'm using more high-pitched stops than I am in the Guillemont, because in the Guillemont you're trying to recreate the sound of a French romantic organ that Guillemont knew, whereas with the Barber you're trying to create a more racy 20th century sound, because he wrote that piece in the 1960s, so for a rather different kind of instrument. Then the third thing you have to do is you have to always bear in mind how well the organ will sound with the orchestra. And you need sometimes to make more adjustments because certain very high-pitched stops can stick out above an orchestra. And whatever music you play, you must always make sure that the sound you're making on the organ blends well with the orchestra.
And it's sometimes difficult for you, sitting at the console, to be able to know that. Do you have someone who's being your ears out in the hall?
Hand signals.
Well, sometimes you do have to have that, because obviously if you're sitting directly underneath the pipes, a lot of the sound goes over your head, and you don't hear the balance as it is heard out in the hall. But the good thing about Overture Hall and many other modern concert halls is that they often have movable consoles which can be placed anywhere on the stage. And for the performances at the weekend, the movable console will actually be in front of the orchestra. Mm-hmm. And I'll be sitting in front of John Demain, the conductor, and the orchestra, and obviously in front of the organ. So I can gauge the balance very easily in this situation. But obviously other situations where the organ console is attached to the pipes, then of course it's very important to have somebody else listening for balance out in the hall.
I suppose you must occasionally get some jarring effects with the sound coming back at you in some halls.
I think you're far enough on the stage for that not to bother you. Obviously in very resonant buildings such as cathedrals, the sound coming back at you can be a problem for clarity. But always when you have an audience there, the sound is soaked up more. But that's not a problem at Overture Hall.
How often do you actually get to play an instrument that is exactly what the composer had in mind?
Very rarely. obviously, I mean, one of the high points for me last year, which was actually just after I'd visited Madison, was playing in Saint-Sulpice in Paris, where Vidor played, and I actually played a couple of movements from his Fifth Symphony, and that was just fantastic to play it on the instrument for which he composed it. But that doesn't happen very often.
There's that great story about Epower Biggs going out and looking for an organ that Handel would have used, and it turned out he found one that actually had been designed by Handel and recorded at a recording of all 16 of those organ concertos in
Packington.
I can remember if it was Great or Little Packington.
That's right, Great Packington. And yet, I mean, there's not absolute proof that Handel actually played that instrument. He might have known of it, but people now say that, you know, there are probably about 100 organs in England that Handel was supposed to have played on, but hardly any of them actually he did.
That's George Washington slept here.
Yes, that's right.
Well, I was reading a little bit about the Barber Toccata Festiva, which is the work on the program, and how he wrote that for what was then the largest movable organ in the world.
Yes, that's
And so that was the beginning of, well, our organ at Overture Hall is also a movable instrument.
Yes, and I'm sure that's bigger than the instrument at the Academy of Music in Philadelphia. In fact, I have a recording of E. Power Biggs playing this piece on the organ where it was. This piece was first premiered. And I have to say that Overture Hall does it much more justice than that recording.
So can you play an instrument like the one at Overture Hall and use it and do justice to something that was written for a much smaller voiced instrument?
Absolutely. I mean, as long as the individual sounds are musically voiced, then, you know, that the instrument is going to be very flexible. I think the problem is that when you have a very small instrument trying to do something that, you know, a huge symphonic organ would need to do, then you would not succeed. But with a large organ, as long as it's been musically designed and voiced, there's no reason why you shouldn't play more chamber music on it. Handel organ concertos, for example.
Well, you're very familiar with the Kleist organs in general. You have a couple of CDs, I believe, solo works on those.
From Symphony Hall, Birmingham, where I'm the resident, and where they also have a Kleist organ, which was built 6 years ago, so just before Overture Hall. Mm-hmm. In fact, the committee headed by Sam Hutchinson, they visited Birmingham just to see what Kleist could do, and I think they were obviously suitably impressed.
I'm pleased.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's one thing that intrigues me about the organ compared to many other instruments is that they're still building these new ones that seem to be as good or better than some of the older ones.
Yes, that's true, and it never ceases to amaze me that electronic instruments haven't taken over, because 30 years ago people were saying, you know, electronic organs, which are much cheaper, are the future of organ building, because nobody will be able to afford to build real pipe organs. And you know how wrong those people have been proved. There's always money for worthwhile projects, and building an organ by a great builder, I think, is a worthwhile project.
Does the homeowner of an organ have a chance at a good instrument, all else taken into account? I mean, does it have to be a large instrument in a hall to really do justice to the sound? Is there such a thing as what used to be called a parlor organ that's really effective?
Well, the thing about a concert hall organ is that, first of all, it's going to be used by many different people from many different traditions. Secondly, the audience want to hear a wide range of music. And thirdly, the organ needs to compete and match the power of a symphony orchestra. And all those three things added up together means a very large instrument with lots of stops and lots of different choices of sounds and lots of power. So that's why you tend to find that concert halls have very large instruments with a large number of stops. So a parlor organ, I don't think, would sound very effective, especially played solo. Obviously, you can have these little chamber organs that are used to play with small chamber orchestras in things like the Bach B minor Mass. But for playing the big solo pieces, obviously, a chamber organ would be totally not up to it.
Mm-hmm. The expectations are different.
Yes, exactly.
So what does this John Stanley sound like?
We have a piece here from your CD, and it's, I think it's this famous little Voluntary by John Stanley.
That's right, yeah. John Stanley was a younger contemporary of Handel in London. Handel actually knew him. He used to go and listen to him play at the Temple Church. And Stanley composed very sort of modest voluntaries, but they're very colourful, and they exploited the colours available on the English organ of the time. And, you know, this is a sort of piece that the Symphony Hall organ is perhaps too big for, but it's got the right kind of colours to bring it off very well.
Speaking with a soft voice, one of John Stanley's voluntaries.
Played by Thomas Trotter. And we were just talking about organs and pipe organs and how they have evolved from smaller instruments and the type of small craftsmen, the shops that they would come from, into the 19th century where they became much bigger.
Yes, that's right. And people's expectations of what an organ should do changed. In the 18th century, people, composers like Bach, wrote their preludes and fugues for one specific sound. But then in the 19th century, people wanted to express different emotions in the same piece, so you needed to get louder and softer. And they also wanted more power and more warm sounds. And again, this meant that people were looking for larger instruments. And in many ways, the organ developed in the way that the symphony orchestra developed, because an 18th century orchestra was quite a bit smaller than your average 19th century symphony orchestra. And in the same way, I would say that the organ developed in that way. It got much bigger and louder, and the tones were more broad. And the halls in which they stood or stand got bigger, you know, concert halls. Mm-hmm. Many concert halls were built in the 19th century.
It'd be interesting to know, for example, well, the orchestra seems to have reached its peak with Berlioz. Did he write anything for the organ, or was that just not enough for him?
I don't think he did. Of course, he wrote a very prominent organ part in the Te Deum. But there are only a couple of movements where the organ just starts the thing off and plays solo, and then the orchestra come crashing in. So I don't think that quite counts.
You do have, on the other side of the channel, you'd have Elgar. Can't imagine it getting much bigger than that, but he did write for the organ.
He wrote the most fantastic sonata, but it was one of his earlier works. Although he wrote it when he was in his 30s, it was before he wrote the Enigma Variations and his symphonies and his oratorio. So it's sometimes referred to as his symphony number naught, because it was his first large-scale piece. But it's a wonderful work. But it's very, very difficult to play. It's very orchestral in that the sounds are always changing, and the changes must be seamless, and they must never be noticeable to an audience. Just as you hear an orchestra playing, you don't notice where, you know, the second violins leave off and the first violins start up, and a clarinet comes in here, then an oboe takes over. And that seamlessness is very difficult to achieve on the organ, but it's exactly what Elgar requires.
I guess, did Elgar play the organ? I mean,
yes, he did.
So he was aware of how tough that piece would be. Huh.
Yes, he was. His father was an organist, and actually Elgar succeeded him playing at the local Catholic church in Worcester, but he didn't stick at it. And he wrote this piece in 5 days flat, and the dedicatee was Hugh Blair, who was organist at Worcester Cathedral, who had to play it at very short notice for the fighting Americans. And apparently it was a bit of a disaster, partly because the piece was so difficult, but also because he didn't have long enough to learn it. So it had a rather checkered history. Bad start.
So does he specify the registrations of each of the sections, or is that...
Hardly any. That's the problem about English music. You find in French music, symphonies by Vidor or Guillemot or César Franck, they're very specific. They write in the music exactly the sounds. And because the French organ tended to be more standard, you could find those sounds on any instrument as long as it was of a certain size. Mm-hmm. Whereas in England, the composers tend to just write the dynamics and expect the organist to match the dynamics to the sounds at their disposal. So it's quite an art registering an English piece. And also, when you change stops, it's nice if there are some gaps in the music, and often the composers didn't leave any gaps in the music. So again, you know, it's difficult to play English music.
What do you suppose makes that Toccata by Berlmann so popular? I mean, what is it that makes a piece catch on like that?
I think if I knew that, I'd be a very rich man. I'd be writing pieces like that. I suppose it's because it's a combination of virtuosity and melodiousness. You've got the sort of manual virtuosity, and then you've got the theme thundering out in the pedals, and it's sort of quite loud, and it gets louder and louder, and it roars away. It's a very typical of a French toccata.
Well, we've got to hear it now.
I think we're committed.
This is the toccata from the Suite Gothique.
Thank you.
Well, it must be fun to play.
You can smooth down your hair now.
Yes, that's right. We're all a little windblown, though. That was the toccata that ends the Suite Gothique of Leon Barrowman, our organist, Thomas Trotter. Let's see.
Well, I have a question which came up at another organist's recital, Olivier Latry, in fact.
Oh, yes.
And he was talking about how he really views the pipe organ not as an instrument but as a partner. And I'm wondering if that's kind of, if that affects a performance and how you think about that. Obviously, working with the instrument rather than
fighting it,
applying your thoughts to it.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you have to feel at one with the instrument to make a success of any performance. And it's a question of seeing what the strengths of the instrument are and trying to ignore its faults. I mean, no instrument is absolutely perfect. But as I was saying earlier on, you have to form a blueprint in your mind of what the organ does and what it does best, and then work to its strengths. And there's just no point in fighting an instrument. You've got to be very open-minded when you're coming to a new instrument and trying to register, trying to choose the stops for the music you're going to play. And sometimes you find that you do something in a completely different way because it suits that organ. So you've got to be very flexible and think on your feet, you know, often at the last minute, especially if you don't have much practice time. Mm-hmm. And that's why organists tend to have to arrive at the concert venue days before to get to know the instrument. That's, and then you feel it does become your partner.
Yeah.
That you probably more than any other performer. I mean, a violinist usually has his or her violin, and they're very well acquainted with that instrument. But and even a pianist usually takes an afternoon, maybe, to.
And the other thing is that there's such a variety of instruments. No two organs are the same, and of all musical instruments, there's more technical expertise required to play on the different manuals, and you've got your feet going, and then you've got to change the stops and work out where all the controls are. So there's a lot to familiarise yourself with, and as Olivier Latry obviously says, you mustn't fight the instrument. You must know it well enough to feel as though you've been playing it all your life.
You know, virtuoso performers on other instruments sometimes we'll make a show of it by making it look more difficult than it is.
Yeah.
I gather you don't have to really do that as an organist. It's hard enough just keeping track of the instrument as it is. Or are there instruments who lay it on?
Well, I mean, sometimes I reach out for a stop, even when I don't need to change the stop, because I think, well, it's a bit boring, I haven't been doing it. You know, because it is quite impressive.
We'll be watching for that.
And I'm giving all my secrets away
there.
So, I mean, I think it's good to have, if you can be seen, obviously, by the audience, because there are lots of venues where the organist is hidden away, so there's no point in doing anything. I mean, but I think the most important thing is always put the music first, and I find it a bit boring watching somebody who's very, very theatrical, but musically is pretty dumb. So,
does it make any difference one way or the other that you're usually or often playing with your back to the audience? You can't see them at all?
Well, that's a good question, because I've never actually played with looking at an audience.
It's almost impossible to do that.
That's right, because even if you could turn the console over to the hall around.
It would still be too tall to see.
But you'd still have them. Yes, it would be too tall for you to see over the music stand.
Yeah.
I think from the audience's point of view, they can't see your facial expressions, which sometimes is a good thing. But apart from that, I'd rather have my back view seen than not be seen at all. Mm. Because the audiences don't realise what's involved with playing the organ.
Oh, for sure.
And actually just seeing somebody's arms moving from side to side or whatever, I think it sort of enhances the musical experience. Because otherwise, you know, some people say, oh, well, we might as well just stay at home and listen to a CD if we can't see you. So I think it's good to be seen, even just the back view.
And of course they love to watch the feet.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, there's the popular misconception about playing the organ is that you use the feet to pump the air. And that's true if you're playing a harmonium, but it's certainly not true if you're playing a pipe organ. And just to see the feet moving around, and in fact, in the Barber Toccata Festival, there's a great cadenza for the for the feet alone, which is great fun to do. It's quite difficult. And people are absolutely amazed because it sounds as though the player is using his hands as well, and of course he's not. So, you know, that's impressive to do, and people love that.
So you really have to be a keyboard player and a tap dancer at the same time.
Yes, yes, that's right.
Light on your feet. Well, you can watch the feet and the hands and hear the orchestra as well. This weekend, the Madison Symphony Orchestra is starting a new season with Thomas Trotter, Friday night, Saturday night, Sunday afternoon, all of the concerts at Overture Hall. And we thank you very much for sharing some of your precious time with us.
Thank you.